of failing to brand the Southerners traitors. Nor was there any political support, except among the vengeful Sumner Stevens cabal, for such a policy. Sometimes there is no good solution to human problems. Certainly, reparations merely reapplies ex post facto reasoning to modern Americans, the vast majority of whose ancestors did not own slaves, and many of whom arrived in the country long after the Civil War. Without a land policy, many freedmen soon fell into a series of contractual labor relationships with former owners, though often not their own, known as sharecropping. Under the sharecropping system, in which two-thirds of all Southern sharecroppers were white, black and white laborers entered into agreements with white plantation owners who possessed land and farm implements but lacked workers. Typical contracts gave the landowner 50% of the crop and the laborers 50%, although drafting a typical sharecropper contract proved daunting. Each contract was individually negotiated, including length, share, the nature of supervision, and so on. In some cases, share tenants provided their own tools, seed, and everything except the land, whereas in others, some freedmen worked purely as wage laborers. Sharecropping has received rough treatment from historians, but less so from economists for a number of reasons. First, given the strengths and weaknesses of the former slave owners and freedmen, it represented a logical market solution, providing land and capital for laborers who lacked both, and a labor system for landowners without laborers. Second, the contracts were far more flexible and competitive than once was thought. They were not lifetime agreements, but temporary arrangements. Third, both parties had to work together to adjust to weather and market changes. Finally, given the lack of education among the freedmen, sharecropping minimized transaction costs while at the same time extended new levels of freedom and responsibility to the ex-slaves. Still, criticisms of sharecropping are warranted because it suffered from many deficiencies. Neither landowner nor laborer had an incentive to significantly upgrade land or implements. Rather, both had an incentive to farm the land into barrenness or to refrain from engaging in technological or management innovations that would improve productivity. Opportunities to gouge the sharecroppers, black and white, also abounded. In some regions, freedmen found it difficult to move about to take advantage of better contract terms. Data on the movement of sharecroppers suggests, however, that their movements correlated strongly with higher-paying contracts, so the implication is that sharecroppers knew where there were better conditions, and therefore monopoly situations occurred less frequently than some economic historians claimed. On average, sharecropping proved an excellent temporary market mechanism. Many freedmen did not stay in that situation, but moved on. Blacks acquired property and wealth more rapidly than whites, a somewhat misleading statistic in that they began with nothing. And across the South, they owned perhaps 9% of all land by 1880. In certain pockets, however, they achieved ownership much more slowly. In Georgia, blacks only owned 2% of the acreage in the state by 1880, and in others, more rapidly. Robert Kenzer's study of North Carolina showed that in five counties, black ownership of town lots rose from 11% in 1875 to almost 19% by 1890, despite legal codes and racism. Black income levels also grew more rapidly than white levels, again in part because they began with virtually no income as it is technically defined. It bears repeating. Racism and discrimination certainly existed and unquestionably took an economic and human toll on the freedmen. But to ignore their hard-won genuine gains or to minimize them as mere exceptions trivializes their contributions and achievements. Moreover, it does a disservice to the freedmen to automatically view them as laborers instead of potential entrepreneurs. Historians have tended to bury stories of black entrepreneurship after the Civil War. Yet many former slaves contributed important inventions and founded useful, profitable companies in the postbellum period. Alabamian Nate Shaw, an illiterate tenant farmer, moved from farm to farm, expanding his share of the crop and renting out his mules to haul lumber or do other odd jobs. Despite competition from an influx of poor whites, struggles with unscrupulous landlords who tried to defraud him of his crops, and merchants reluctant to extend him credit, Shaw persevered until he became self-sufficient and headed the Sharecroppers Union, where, as an older man, he led protests against land seizures by sheriff's deputies in the 1930s. Fellow Alabamian Andrew Jackson Beard, born a slave in Jefferson County, found it too expensive to haul apples from his farm to Montgomery, whereupon he quit farming and constructed a flour mill in Hardwicks, Alabama. Experimenting with plow designs, he patented a plow in 1881, sold the patent 3 years later for $4,000, a large sum at the time, and returned to inventing. By the 1890s, he had accumulated $30,000 and entered the real estate market, although he continued to invent, creating a rotary steam engine in 1892. He had worked previously on railroads, and he knew the dangers of joining railroad cars together, a process done entirely by hand, in which a worker would place a large metal pin in the coupling devices at exactly the right instant. Misjudgment cost railroaders their hands and fingers, and Beard himself suffered the loss of a leg crushed in a coupler accident. As a solution, in 1897, Beard came up with the famous Jenny coupler, reverse metal hands that fold backward on contact, then latch like hands shaking. Variants of the Jenny remain in use on railroads today, and over the years, Beard's invention has saved untold thousands of railroad employees from severe personal injury. The credit records for Virginia of R.G. Dunn and Company, for example, reveal that of the 1,000 enterprises about which the company kept information between 1865 and 1879, more than 220 were black-owned and operated. Although black businesses were usually located in areas of town with higher black populations, the advertising indicates that African-American entrepreneurs appealed to white customers, too. Almost 80% of the firms were single-owner operations, and these entrepreneurs quickly gained experience in the workplace. After 1869, the ratio of new to failed firms dropped, and even some of those that closed did so because the proprietor had died. In fact, the Virginia records showed virtually no difference in failure rates between black merchants and white merchants from 1870 to 1875, despite the presence of racism and prejudice. Attitudes of freedmen toward former masters spanned the spectrum. Some former slaves actually expressed anger at Union troops for killing and maiming their young masses. One South Carolina slave, seeing one of the master's four sons return home from battle, "he'd jaw split and he'd teeth all shine through the cheeks," was "so mad I could have killed all the Yankees." Other slaves secretly celebrated when tragic news came to the plantation's mistress. "It made us glad to see them cry," said one slave. "They made us cry so much." News that a local leader of slave patrols had been killed touched off joyous shouting in slave quarters. On occasion, wartime hardships turned once lenient masters and mistresses into monsters. One mistress, hearing of her son's death, whipped the slaves until she collapsed of exhaustion. A Virginia slave observed that treatment of blacks grew harsher as the Yankee armies came closer. Facing blacks now as tenants and sharecroppers, more than a few whites viewed their former chattel with suspicion. "The tenants act pretty well towards us," wrote a Virginia woman, "but that doesn't prevent our being pretty certain of their intention to stampede when they get a good chance. They are nothing but an ungrateful, discontented lot, and I don't care how soon I get rid of mine. Another owner in Texas, a pretty good boss, as slave owners went, made a huge mistake when informing his slaves of their emancipation. "You can just work on if you want to, and I'll treat you just like I always did." All but one family, like birds, just flew. The Freedmen's Bureau attempted to serve as a clearinghouse for economic and family information, but its technology was too primitive and the task too Herculean. Somewhat more successful were the efforts by Northern teachers, missionaries, and administrators to assist slaves in military and contraband camps by writing letters for freedmen trying to reach relatives. After black newspapers were established in the 1870s, advertisements frequently sought information on family members separated during slavery. The influence of black educators like Booker T. Washington was still more than a decade away. Washington, the son of a slave, had just started his teaching career in 1875 as Reconstruction wound down. Founding the Tuskegee Institute, Washington hired faculty, established productive relationships with local whites, raised money, recruited students, and set about to teach printing, carpentry, botany, cabinet making, farming, cooking, and other skills that would assist freedmen and their children in gaining employment quickly. He obtained benefactions from Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, and George Eastman, and suffered insults in order to advance his view of black success. Without ignoring racial discrimination and hatred, Washington nevertheless focused on encouraging African Americans to acquire property, get education, and to live with impeccable character. In time, he believed, relations would improve. At the Atlanta Cotton States and International Exposition in September 1895, Washington delivered a speech later noted for its ambiguity and elasticity. He seemed to accept the separate but equal Jim Crow doctrine of the day, yet he reminded whites that blacks were not going away, and that ultimately they had to work together. Freedmen and politics in the South. The second major question involving the freedmen, their political status, was almost immediately put to the test when, at the end of the war, blacks began to move about the South freely for the first time. This churning of human movement struck every observer, including Northern Army officers who witnessed train depots and country roads crammed with people. Hungry, sick, and barely clad freedmen clogged the roads between Vicksburg and Jackson. More than 125,000 slaves had been removed to Texas when the war started, and by late 1865 they were heading home up the San Antonio Road to North Carolina and Georgia. Although much of the wandering reflected a desire to express the freedom of movement suddenly given to the former slaves, more of the travel had the purpose of searching for family members or better work. Regardless of the motivation, any movement by free blacks terrified whites and led to the first real clash between the federal and state governments over political rights in Reconstruction policies. As the new Southern governments created by Johnson's generous Reconstruction policies started to function, they passed laws designed to place restraints on blacks in negotiating contracts, travel, and weapons and property ownership. Mississippi, after what Governor B.G. Humphreys called 6 months of the administration of this black incubus, passed the South's first black codes in January 1866. The legislation required annual employment contracts, prohibited movement between counties without permission, and allowed local officials to arrest any black youth on charges of vagrancy if he did not appear to have a job. The Mississippi Black Code was not entirely punitive. It recognized black marriages, something not done in slavery, legitimized the Negro's right to sue in civil court, confirmed his right to property, and required that all contracts with freedmen of periods longer than a month be in writing. Some of the guarantees were meaningless. To freedmen, most of whom were illiterate and had never had any contact with the legal system or the courts, the right to sue was hollow. The provisions that stirred up the most revulsion among blacks, and which provoked the North to start down the road of congressional reconstruction, involved the vagrancy provisions. Vagrants were to be fined up to $100 and imprisoned. Worse, if a freedman was unable to pay the fine, he could be hired out as an apprentice until his fine and court costs were covered. Another set of laws, ingeniously devised by individual states, placed huge license fees on recruiters who came in from other states to lure freedmen to work for better wages. The only purpose of the statutes was to limit blacks' freedom of movement and infringe upon their free right to contract. White state governments also received support from plumbers, barbers' unions, and medical groups, all dominated by whites, who established a variety of tests to keep blacks out of their ranks. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the so-called slaughterhouse cases, finally ruled that if economic regulations did not explicitly discriminate, they were valid. And not until 1905, with the decision in the case of Lochner versus New York, did the court reverse itself and bar certain types of discriminatory state, union, guild, and business regulation. It was a hollow victory for the freedmen, 30 years too late to do them any good. Black codes alone, however, even without the supporting labor regulations, sufficiently alarmed Northerners, threatening no less than a backdoor re-enslavement of black men, and General O.O. Howard ordered his Freedmen's Bureau to disregard the state laws. Northern newspapers editorialized against the codes, but their complaints did not stop South Carolina and Louisiana from enacting similar, though milder, versions of the Black Codes, and the towns of Opelousas and Franklin passed still more stringent measures. Florida, however, topped them all. By 1866, Florida's population was nearly half black, and its white legislature teetered on the brink of paranoia. Florida laws required the death penalty for burglary, insurrection, except when the insurrection was by ex-Confederates, and, of course, rape of only white women. Freedmen were allowed to have schools, but not at state expense. Blacks were denied the right to bear arms or assemble after dark, clearly violating the provisions of the United States Constitution. At the other end of the spectrum were the lenient codes of Tennessee and Virginia. But the black codes created a major backlash in the North. Some states repealed their black codes, but it was too late. By then, congressional radicals were arguing that the codes were further evidence the South would never reform itself. Associated with the imposition of the black codes was the birth and growth of the Ku Klux Klan. A Pulaski, Tennessee white supremacy group founded in 1866, the Klan held a regional meeting a year later in Nashville, where former Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest became its first Grand Wizard. Wearing white sheets and hoods, not only to conceal their identities, but, they thought, to play on the superstitious nature of blacks, Klansmen spread a reign of terror across the South, lynching blacks and any whites who might support them. The Klan, although not yet including Catholics and Jews in its attacks, often left its calling card, a burning cross, at a terror scene. Eventually, the Klan spread nationally through the establishment of claverns, local organizations, but it had its greatest 19th century influence in Tennessee, North Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. Other copycat white supremacy groups followed: the White Brotherhood, the Men of Justice, the Constitutional Union Guards, and the Knights of the White Camellia. Mayhem and violence spread. Albion Tourget, a northern carpetbagger who became a North Carolina judge, counted 12 murders, 9 rapes, 14 cases of arson, and over 700 beatings in his political district alone. Turgot's novel, A Fool's Errand, exposed in fiction some of the harsh realities of Klan terror in the South. One of the bloodiest incidents occurred in 1873 at Colfax, Louisiana courthouse, where a white mob attacked armed blacks, killing more than 100 and mutilating their bodies. The federal government, after indicting 98 whites, convicted only 3, and even those convictions were later thrown out by the Supreme Court in the Cruikshank decision, which said that the Reconstruction Amendments only applied to governments, not the actions of individuals. Not only had the federal government failed to give the freedmen land, but it also failed to facilitate their self-defense, which made the 14th Amendment and its reaffirming of all the Constitution's protections, including the Second Amendment, though not specifically mentioned in the 14th Amendment, all the more important. If any agency could have addressed some of the needs of the freedmen, it was the Freedmen's Bureau. Yet the history of the Bureau shows it was not capable of dealing with the likes of the Ku Klux Klan or the Black Codes. Nevertheless, the Freedmen's Bureau provides an object lesson in the limits of both good intentions and government power. O.O. Howard and the Freedmen's Bureau. In March 1865, Congress created the Freedmen's Bureau to help former slaves in their transition to freedom. Run by General Oliver Otis O.O. Howard, the Bureau lay for months at the center of a struggle between the Treasury and War Departments over which would handle the freedmen after the war. Stanton's War Department won, as it would ultimately have to enforce any edicts, and Stanton trusted Howard as an honest and effective leader. Although an executive branch agency, the Freedmen's Bureau was viewed by Congress as a wedge with which it could gain control of Reconstruction. O.O. Howard was hardly physically intimidating. Possessing a slight build, fidgety gestures, and a shrill voice, the general was nonetheless a morally imposing figure, proud that he was known in the nation as the Christian soldier. A devout believer who insisted that his subordinates attend prayer meetings and enforced temperance among his troops, he had long opposed slavery, though he did not have the abolitionist credentials of his brother Roland. O.O. had studied at West Point, where, before the war, criticism of slavery was prohibited. His studies, however, marked him for success. He graduated 4th behind Robert E. Lee's son Custis. After Fort Sumter, Howard served in several field commands in the East, then in occupation forces. He reveled in giving Christian inspirational talks to the freedmen's children at the schools established in the Sea Islands. Howard asked the central question facing the government: what shall we do with the Negro? He answered by emphasizing education and Christianity. The Bureau would unleash a great commission of compassionate Americans, teachers, ministers, farmers, superintendents, who would aid and elevate the freedmen. Biblical charity, however, always came with strict stipulations. He who will not work shall not eat, for example, and the numerous provisions in Proverbs against sloth. Howard did not see that the do-gooder instinct would unleash a monster that would spread in 3 separate directions. First, although the Bureau definitely aided the freedmen more than any other agency or group, it inevitably fostered dependence on government. Second, social work of this type often, if not always, tends to puff up the provider, whose role as the source of blessings inflates his own sense of worth, not to mention ego. It is not surprising, therefore, that Northerners who came south with good intentions ended up branded as carpetbaggers, seen only as leeches sucking off Southern vitality. Third, the Bureau itself, like all government institutions, was bound to be corrupted by the flow of money and the religious zeal of the participants. When nothing short of heaven on earth is at stake, the disappearance or unauthorized use of funds and equipment cannot stand in the way of progress. As an executive office carrying out policies philosophically more in tune with those of the congressional radicals, the Freedmen's Bureau was itself bound to become a source of controversy. For example, Howard supported key legislation during presidential Reconstruction that brought the 40 acres and a mule dispute to a head. A March 3, 1865 Act of Congress gave commissioners of the Bureau authority to select and set apart such confiscated and abandoned lands and property as may be deemed necessary for the immediate use of the refugees. Howard then affixed his own Circular Order No. 13 in July, saying that the Amnesty Proclamation will not be understood to extend to the surrender of abandoned or confiscated property. This amounted to nothing less than Howard's attempting to hijack Johnson's policy to meet his own radical ends, and Johnson rebuked him. Undeterred, Howard instituted quiet yet forceful opposition to Johnson's policies, constituting an act of insubordination on behalf of blacks no different from Sherman's defiance of Lincoln. With the rescinding of Circular Order No. 13, any hope for a reasonably quick march toward self-sufficiency for the freedmen vanished. Most turned their expectations from land ownership to wage labor. "The Yankees preach nothing but cotton, cotton," complained a Sea Islands freedman. It was equally unrealistic, however, to expect former slaves who had worked for nothing all their lives to suddenly display as a group the traits of capitalist entrepreneurs who had scrimped, saved, and suffered in their own way to accumulate wealth. Entrepreneurship and capital formation skills did not come to any group instantly or easily. The Bureau did what it could, attempting to police the work contracts, but often was viewed as little more than the planters' guards and nothing else. Even there, however, one way lower-paid groups got ahead was by fighting for their own wage increases, moving to better jobs, and most of all, starting their own businesses, all of which the Bureau inadvertently discouraged. On the other hand, the Bureau hardly constituted an early form of great society welfareism. Certainly it increased the size and scope of federal government operations. For example, it supervised more than 3,000 schools serving 150,000 Southern students, demanding a massive amount of oversight. And without argument, the Bureau wasted money and, in some cases, encouraged indolence. Yet, in the short term, the Freedmen's Bureau was indispensable. More than 90% of the students in Reconstruction schools were black, and they were provided with education they would never have received in elite Southern private schools. Keeping them in school, however, proved difficult. One estimate of black student attendance between 1865 and 1870 was 5%, and for whites it was only 20% of the enrollment. Reformers had an answer for that, too, pushing, as they did in the North, for mandatory attendance laws, again expanding the scope of the government power. The most enduring contribution of the Freedmen's Bureau was its commitment to African Americans' self-sufficiency, if not equality, and Southerners knew it. "The black ball is in motion," lamented Mary Chestnut, "and once rolling, racist whites could only slow it down, not stop it." Some whites hoped that by teaching blacks to support themselves, white Southerners would quickly return to their rightful place atop the social ladder. Johnson's Amnesty Proclamation seemed to confirm black fears when former Confederates learned that when their citizenship rights were restored, their confiscated property would be returned as well. Or, in language plain to the freedmen, no plantations would be broken up for 40 acres and a mule. Left-wing historians often leap to make the land issue solely about race. Two other important considerations, however, guided Johnson as he came to his amnesty, sans confiscation, decision. First, simply put, there were more whites than blacks in the South. At minimum, there were two potential white troublemakers for every disgruntled black. In meting out justice, however unfair, sheer numbers are always a calculation. Second, Whites were voters, or in the South, potential voters, whereas blacks were not, at least realistically not in large numbers unless escorted by troops. No policy could survive long if Southern whites and those Northerners who feared black social equality formed a political alliance to oust Johnson and the radicals, even if somehow they formed an unlikely united front. These were not minor considerations. To accuse Johnson of abandoning the Negro, though in essence true, nevertheless obscures the political realities confronting him. Moreover, Johnson's own preferences were to elevate poor whites, not create black competitors for them. The Freedmen's Bureau provided a qualified answer to the third Reconstruction question. The South, in an extremely limited way, could be made to comply with some of the Northern Reconstruction agenda through clear direction and, above all, heavy application of force. But in the broadest sense of racial harmony, genuine political equality, and diffuse economic growth, Reconstruction could not change either human nature or historical prejudices. At any rate, the conflict between Johnson and Howard spotlighted the last Reconstruction question. Who would direct Reconstruction for the remainder of its life, the legislative or the executive branch? A war on four fronts. Congress, disenchanted with Johnson's slow pace, had already started to gain control of the direction of Reconstruction. Four concurrent conflicts took place from late 1865 to 1876, and each had the potential to dramatically reshape American life. The first battle pitted Congress against the presidency for policy dominance. Laments about Lincoln's untimely death obscure the fact that, had the great man lived, it would have made little difference to radicals in Congress, who, although they may have despised the Tennessee tailor, were hardly cowed by Lincoln. A second clash involved Northerners seeking to cement their commercial and political superiority over the South into a permanent hierarchy. Third, the Republican Party intended to emasculate, if not destroy, the opposition Democratic Party. And fourth, a tension between whites and blacks over social, political, and economic equality had only started to play out in both sections, but mostly below the Mason-Dixon line. In this last dimension, the radicals had for the most part been open and straightforward in their goals. They had argued for abolition from the beginning of the war, and they were, if anything, somewhat less opportunistic in their purposes and a little more candid in their public utterances than the average American politician. George W. Julian of Indiana, for example, lectured fellow Republicans, saying, "The real trouble is that we hate the Negro. It is not his ignorance that offends us, but his color. Let one rule be adopted for white and black alike." Other radicals warned Northerners that the rights of black and white laborers were synonymous, and, above all, they maintained a fever pitch of moral frenzy begun during the war. "Absolute right must prevail," said a Chicago radical, while editor E.L. Godkin predicted that accepting the doctrine that the United States was subject to only white man's government would make the name of American democracy a hissing and a byword among people of the earth. Sentiments such as these refute the notion that the egalitarianism of radical Reconstruction was merely a facade for Northern economic dominance. As the new Congress considered Johnson's Reconstruction program, it became increasingly clear to radicals that although blacks in the South could not vote, they nevertheless counted 100% instead of 60% toward representation in the House, giving the Southern Democrats even more seats in the House of Representatives than they had had before the war. As this incredible reality sank in, the Republican-dominated Congress reacted by refusing to seat the representatives of any of the Southern governments. I am not very anxious, wrote Thaddeus Stevens in a moment of great candor, to see Southern votes cast along with others to control the next election. This played a crucial role in the shaping of the subsequent 14th Amendment, in which the radicals proportionately reduced representation in the House to any state denying voting rights to the freedmen. Johnson and his Northern Democratic allies, along with the leaders of the reconstructed neo-Confederate governments, accepted at the outset that blacks were incapable of exercising citizenship rights. The chasm between the two races in physical, mental, and moral characteristics, Johnson wrote in his third annual message to Congress, will prevent an amalgamation or fusion of them together in one homogeneous mass. Blacks were inferior, and if they gained political power, it would result in tyranny such as this continent has never yet witnessed. In February 1866, Johnson won his last victory over Congress when he vetoed an extension of the Freedmen's Bureau on the grounds that until the 11 Southern states were restored to the Union, Congress had no authority to pass such legislation. Congress sustained his veto, but the radicals stepped up their campaign against him. Sumner described Johnson as an insolent, drunken brute, and Stevens called him an alien enemy of a foreign state. Here was Johnson, who seldom drank and whose loyalty to the Union was such that he was the only senator from a secessionist state to stay in office during the war, accused of drunkenness and treason. Arrayed against Johnson and his dwindling alliance, the radicals saw their influence grow. Thaddeus Stevens best expressed their position when he rejected the notion held by Southerners that the government of the United States was a white man's government. "This is man's government, the government of all men alike," he countered. He therefore advocated full political equality, though not social equality, calling it a matter of taste as to whether people shared their seats at their dinner table with blacks. Between the radicals on one side and the former Confederates on the other stood the so-called moderates. Moderates hated the black codes and wanted Republican dominance of the South, but they rejected full political equality for blacks. They agreed with the radicals, though, that something had to be done about the laws passed by the restored, yet still rebellious, governments in the South, and together the two groups passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, defining blacks as U.S. citizens and promising them full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of person and property as is enjoyed by white citizens. This law made it a federal crime to deprive someone of his civil rights, and in conjunction with a new Freedmen's Bureau law, established army tribunals to enforce civil rights cases. Johnson promptly vetoed the bill, citing a number of objections. He disliked the absence of a period of adjustment to citizenship that normally occurred with alien immigrants. Social discrimination in areas such as interracial marriage, he thought, also was necessary. His main concerns, though, were over upsetting the balance of power between states and the federal government. Johnson argued that the Civil Rights Act violated the 10th Amendment. Congress narrowly passed the Civil Rights Act over his veto, thanks to the illness of one pro-Johnson voter who stayed home, and the defection of a New York Democrat. Aside from Gideon Welles, all of Johnson's own cabinet opposed him. It was increasingly clear that Andrew Johnson would not support any law that in any way significantly improved the status of African Americans. During the debate over the 14th Amendment, Johnson's views would become even more transparent. Aware that Southerners would immediately bring a court challenge to the Civil Rights Act, Republican legislators moved to make it permanent through the 14th Amendment, stating, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside." This made citizenship national rather than subject to state authority, marking a sea change in the understanding of the source of rights in the United States. No state could abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, or deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Nor could any state deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Subsequently, all state legislation regarding infringements on the Bill of Rights would be subjected to federal review. It was a sweeping accomplishment in defining the rights of all American citizens as equal. Some, however, were more equal than others. While granting citizenship to the freedmen, the 14th Amendment simultaneously denied citizenship to high Confederate officeholders. Meanwhile, from March to June 1866, the Joint Committee on Reconstruction held its hearings, substantially biased against the South. Calling 77 Northerners living in the South, 57 Southerners, and a handful of freedmen, the committee listened to hours of critical testimony, quickly dismissing hostile witnesses. Northern newspapers carried the testimony, which convinced Northern voters of Southern mistreatment of blacks. When the committee delivered its report, it convinced most objective observers that, despite the lopsided way in which the committee gathered evidence, serious abuses of the freedmen continued. Worse, the committee concluded that a state of rebellion still existed in the South and recommended Confederate states be denied representation in the Congress. With this report, Congress reasserted its authority over that of the executive to direct Reconstruction. Johnson remained set in his objections that no ratification process for the 14th Amendment could occur until the Southern states were reinstated. He encouraged the Southern governments to reject the amendment, which they did. Only Tennessee ratified it. Otherwise, the South held out for the midterm 1866 elections, which it hoped would oust the hated radicals. Johnson's response to the 14th Amendment, combined with a maladroit campaign tour in late August, helped swing the election further to the radicals. His obstinacy confirmed his Southern loyalties in the minds of many Northerners, and late summer race riots in New Orleans and Memphis seemed to expose the failure of the president's program. In the fall campaign, radicals linked support of the reconstructed governments to the treason of the hated wartime Copperheads. Voters agreed and sent a two-thirds Republican majority to each house, with more radicals than ever filling their numbers. Congress had finally gained ascendancy over Reconstruction policy. With Johnson essentially neutered, Congress proceeded to act on the Joint Committee's recommendations by passing the Military Reconstruction Act. Under this law, governments formed under presidential reconstruction were swept away as illegitimate, and instead the South was divided into five military districts, each commanded by a loyal Republican general. Johnson vetoed the act of March 2, 1867, and Congress overrode his veto. Under the First Reconstruction Act, its very title implying that Johnson had not presided over any legitimate reconstruction, Southern states now had to hold new constitutional conventions. Instead of the 10% rule that guided the earlier conventions, these new conventions were to be selected by universal manhood suffrage. Readmission to the Union required that the new state constitutions recognize the 14th Amendment and guarantee blacks the right to vote. Congress would sit as the sole judge of whether a state had complied. The military commanders, a la the 14th Amendment, prohibited high Confederate officeholders from voting or holding office, and had authority to determine what constituted a legal election. The process ensured that more blacks voted and fewer whites did. Commanders registered voters in large numbers, 703,000 blacks and 627,000 whites, and in five states blacks were the majority of all voters. Military tribunals investigated a person's loyalty, and some estimates suggest as many as 500,000 whites were disqualified. Thus emerged the hated triumvirate of scalawags, carpetbaggers, and black Republicans to put the radical Southern governments in power. Scalawags, or Southerners who chose to ally with the Republicans, acted out of a variety of motivations. The term scalawag was a folk expression for mean, lousy cattle. Many scalawags were pre-war Whigs, never comfortable with the Democratic Party. Some, such as Confederate General James Longstreet, saw the Republicans as the only hope for Southerners to regain control of their states. Others included Joe Brown, the governor of Georgia, who switched parties only temporarily for financial gain, and the Gray Ghost, Virginia Colonel John Singleton Mosby. The term carpetbaggers referred to Northerners who came south to impose their views on Dixie. They traveled with their suitcases or carpet bags and were scorned by Southerners as do-gooders. Some, if not most, were well-intentioned teachers, missionaries, doctors, and administrators who all flocked to the South to assist both freedmen and the devastated white communities. But more than a few were arrogant and impulsive, caring little for the traditions they crushed or the delicate social tensions that remained. The third leg of the Reconstruction tripod, the Black Republicans, were also hated by all but a few progressive Southerners. At best, Southerners saw free blacks as pawns of the Republicans, and at worst, a threat to their social order. Nevertheless, for the first time under these Reconstruction governments, African Americans won seats in the U.S. government. Black Reconstruction, as Southerners called it, put a number of freedmen in positions of power. Between 1869 and 1901, there were 2 black U.S. senators and 16 congressmen elected. Like many of his colleagues, Blanche Kelso Bruce, 1841 to 98, the U.S. senator from Mississippi, was highly qualified. Born into slavery in Virginia, Bruce was tutored by his master's son and worked as a printer's apprentice. When the Civil War started, he escaped north, and after the Union Army rejected his attempt to enlist, he taught school, attended Oberlin College, and worked as a steamboat porter. After the war, Bruce moved to Mississippi, where he became a prosperous landowner and served in low-level elected offices. Serving as sheriff of Bolivar County, he gained the favor of the Republicans at Jackson, and after a few high-profile appointments, was elected to the Senate by the Mississippi Legislature in 1874. Bruce fought against the Chinese Exclusion Act, spoke in favor of Indian rights, and became the first African American to chair a Senate committee. Once the Redeemer Democrats regained power, they ousted him. But Bruce had so impressed the National Republicans that he received a handful of votes for vice president in 1880. Another black U.S. senator, Hiram Revels, was a free man in North Carolina before attending school in the North. Ordained a minister by the African Methodist Church, Revels headed congregations in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Tennessee, Kentucky, Missouri, and Kansas before moving to Maryland. After April 1861, he worked for the Union cause in Maryland by organizing black regiments and then recruited African Americans to serve in Missouri. Like Bruce, he settled in Mississippi after the war and held local alderman positions, then state senator positions in Adams County, before the Mississippi legislature named him to fill Jefferson Davis's seat. His appointment actually preceded Bruce's, though it was much shorter, lasting only until the end of 1871, when he returned to assume the presidency of Alcorn College, Mississippi's first black university. Bruce, Revels, and other African Americans elected during Black Reconstruction, regardless of their qualifications, only stayed in office by the good graces of the Republican governments. More precisely, they could only hold office as long as the military allowed them to. The presence of black elected officials exaggerated the perception that the radical governments ruled only through force. Increasingly, there was also a real awareness that some were horribly corrupt. Their legislatures issued bonds for any project, no matter how financially unstable. Virtually all the governors accepted bribes to grant charters or franchises. Governor Henry Warmoth in Louisiana, for example, reputedly stashed away a cool $100,000 from public works contracts. Alabama printed $18 to $20 million worth of railroad bonds, and the overall debt of the 11 former Confederate states was estimated to exceed $132 million by 1872, yet with no tangible results for the expenditures. Printing costs mysteriously soared. In South Carolina, the cost of state printing from 1868 to 1876 surpassed the total printing expenses from the entire period from 1789 to 1868. Legislators put in requests for supplies such as perfume, hams, ladies' bonnets, and champagne, all obviously essential to passing good laws. Reconstruction governments thus featured a disturbing mix of Northern reformers, Southern opportunists, and a sea of inexperienced blacks with practically no capital and little economic clout. Had all the motives of the actors been pure, the task of running the governments efficiently and without corruption would have been difficult. And without doubt, many in the Reconstruction governments sincerely wanted to improve the lives of all. They introduced some of the first public schools in the South, enacted prison and asylum reforms, and enforced the 14th Amendment rights of the freedmen. Without the support of Southern whites, absent their own economic base and lacking any political experience, the governments did what governments often do. They threw money at the problems. No transportation? Issue railroad bonds that would never be paid. No education? Throw up a school and assume educated blacks would somehow be respected by their former masters. It would be a mistake to assume that the radicals lacked democratic support for these measures. Even in the South, most of the railroad bond measures were bipartisan and remained so until the Panic of 1873. Only after a new group of Bourbon Redeemer Democrats had appeared, those interested in repudiating the debts and rejecting state aid to railroad projects, did support for the measures dry up. Moreover, concern over graft and government excess grew to the point that when the Bourbons took the scene after 1870, they found voters receptive to reducing the size of government and lowering taxes. As these trends unfolded in the South, Republicans in Washington had a veto-proof majority, although Johnson still had enforcement powers. As commander-in-chief of the Army, the only institution capable of actually putting Reconstruction policies into practice, Johnson could still control the pace of change. He also found a surprising ally in the Supreme Court, which in the ex parte Milligan case, 1866, unanimously ruled against imposition of martial law in cases where civil administration still functioned. This cut the legal legs out from under the military governance in the South, and the court proceeded to rule against loyalty oaths and allowed civil suits against military governors for damages. Congress, sensing where the court was headed, used its discretionary powers granted in Article 3 of the Constitution to state that the court had no jurisdiction in cases of habeas corpus, the issue that had been spawned by Milligan. Congress succeeded in evading the Constitution's stipulation that only wartime suspension of civil government was legal. The war was over. But the court had no way to enforce its ruling. Checkmated, the court withdrew from accepting most other Reconstruction-related decisions. Now only Johnson stood between Congress and its vision of a prostrate South. Concerned the president might outmaneuver them by using his constitutional power as head of the executive branch to go directly through the officer corps in the Union Army, in February 1867, the radicals passed the Tenure of Office Act, a measure that prohibited Johnson from removing federal office holders without Senate approval. This act violated a 78-year precedent and, in essence, handcuffed the president from removing incompetent or even dangerous officials if they had allies in the Senate. Johnson, as expected, vetoed the measure, and Congress, as expected, overrode the veto. At the same time, Congress passed the Command of the Army Act, requiring presidential orders or orders from the Secretary of War, radical sympathizer Stanton, to go through the General of the Army, in that case Ulysses S. Grant. Moreover, it stipulated Grant could not be assigned to duty in any area other than Washington, anticipating that Johnson might send him on a fact-finding mission to, say, China. In fact, Grant wanted to maintain a low profile. Although he seldom agreed with Johnson, Grant appreciated the separation of powers and understood the necessity for keeping the executive branch an independent, powerful check on Congress. Although his sympathies in matters of Reconstruction favored the Republicans, he nevertheless supported Johnson's orders and attempted to execute them. Johnson, convinced many of these congressional acts were unconstitutional, decided to challenge the Tenure of Office Act. He removed Stanton in August while Congress was adjourned, replacing him with Grant as Secretary of War. He sent the Senate an explanation of his reasons in a December communication, but it was too late. The Senate rejected Johnson's statement for removing Stanton by a whopping 35-6 vote. And on January 14, 1868, it was time for Grant to pick up his things and vacate the War Department office. Scarcely a month later, in February 1868, Johnson dismissed Stanton a second time and replaced him with Lorenzo Thomas. Modern readers must note that in the 19th century context of separation of powers, the Congress had no constitutional right of review for executive appointment officers. In firing and hiring cabinet members, Johnson was not only fully within his constitutional rights, but he was in keeping with the actions of virtually every chief executive before him. Realistically, however, the radicals saw Johnson as an obstacle to their programs, and neither the law nor the Constitution could be allowed to stand in the way. At any rate, with the Thomas appointment, a truly extraordinary scene unfolded. Stanton refused to vacate his office and had a warrant issued for Thomas's arrest, whereas Johnson sent Thomas's name, the second in a few months, to the Senate for approval. This time there was no doubt among the House Judiciary Committee members, who recommended 11 articles of impeachment for high crimes and misdemeanors. 9 articles specifically related to Stanton's illegal in the eyes of the House dismissal. 1 involved Johnson's speeches. And the 11th catch-all article lumped together every charge the radicals could find. It was Thaddeus Stevens's moment of triumph, so ill that he had to have the clerk read his speech inaugurating the impeachment committee. He was nevertheless so obsessed by enmity toward Johnson that he lashed out, "Unfortunate, unhappy man, behold your doom." So spiteful was Stevens's speech that the Northern press stood back aghast. The New York Herald wrote that Stevens had the bitterness and hatred of Marat and the unscrupulousness of Robespierre. Although many historians condemn the impeachment process as rash, reckless, and unwarranted, it is significant that the full House vote was a substantial 126-47. This was a ratio far higher than the House impeachment vote against Bill Clinton a century later, 228-206, on the key article of perjury following a sexual harassment suit brought against him. A Senate trial of Johnson soon followed. Although modern Americans are slightly more familiar with the processes of impeachment because of the Clinton case, the mechanics are nevertheless worth restating. After a full House vote in favor of articles of impeachment, the president is officially impeached, but then must stand trial before the Senate. The prosecutors of the case are House managers who present the evidence for removing the chief executive. According to the Constitution, the House, and only the House, determines whether the offenses constitute high crimes and misdemeanors. In other words, once the House has turned out articles of impeachment, the Senate's only constitutional function is to determine guilt or innocence. Senators cannot, at least according to the Constitution, determine that a president is guilty, yet conclude that removal is too great a penalty. Rather, the House has already found that if the president committed the acts of which he was accused, the penalty is automatic. This structure, however, produced an unfortunate flaw in practice, namely that since the Senate would always be the second and final body to judge a president, its members could ignore the requirement that they rule on guilt or innocence only, and instead re-argue the question of whether the behavior fits the high crimes and misdemeanors bar. Both American impeachment trials resulted in the Senates of the respective day ignoring their constitutional charge and insinuating themselves in the powers and prerogatives of the House. When the House managers prepared their case, John A. Bingham of Ohio headed the prosecution. Formerly opposed to impeachment, Bingham had finally concluded that Johnson had to go. Radicals dominated the prosecution team and took the most extreme positions, attempting to paint Johnson as a wild-eyed dictator bent on overthrowing the government. In a remarkable display, Senator Benjamin Butler waved a nightshirt allegedly stained with the blood of an Ohio carpetbagger who had been flogged by Mississippi ruffians to show the lawlessness of the South. From that point, in every election, Republicans would wave the bloody shirt, and the tactic proved effective until the mid-1880s. It was less useful for Bingham, however. Johnson's defense attorneys made eloquent speeches on the president's behalf. More important, no one could produce evidence of treason or truly criminal intent by Johnson, who had sought only to challenge a constitutional question. All this made the moderates uneasy about the precedent of unseating a sitting president. When the Senate voted on the catch-all Article 11, the total was 35 to convict and 19 not guilty, providing Johnson with a single vote margin needed to keep him in office. The Senate had voted to keep an unpopular president in office on the basis that his crimes were not sufficient to warrant his removal. The American system depended on officials being virtuous and observing the law. When the chief executive, such as Andrew Jackson, who ignored the Supreme Court's ruling, or Johnson, who defied Congress, chooses not to obey the law, the removal process virtually always boils down to personal popularity or individual intent. Up to the present, no president has so lacked in either of those categories as to warrant conviction. Other acquittals for Johnson quickly followed, and the trial ended. Some assumed that merely the impeachment and the trial would chastise and restrain Johnson, but the stubborn Tennessean dug in his heels even more. The trial did chasten the radicals, who realized they had pushed too hard, and they reluctantly concluded that the nation was not yet in agreement with their vision of absolute black equality or northern domination of the South. They concluded that winning the White House again in 1868 would require someone not obviously associated with their faction and someone the public trusted. The Republican National Convention in Chicago took only one ballot to choose Ulysses S. Grant as the party's nominee. Johnson vainly attempted to form a Lincoln-type coalition, but he could not win the nomination of his own party. Instead, the Democrats turned to Horatio Seymour, New York's wartime governor who had castigated Lincoln as a dictator and despot, and called the Irish draft rioters "my friends." Republicans had no trouble painting Seymour as a copperhead, nor was he helped by a new wave of Klan racial violence in the South. Seymour's running mate, Frank P. Blair, Jr. of Missouri, made matters worse by referring to the corrupt military despotism that still governed the South. Statements such as Blair's terrified Northerners. Edward Pierpont, a Democrat from New York City, wrote, "I cannot conceive how any intelligent man who does not wish the rebels returned to power and the lost cause restored can vote against Grant." Grant hewed to the traditional Republican agenda: high tariffs, internal improvements, and, above all, stability and moderation toward Reconstruction affairs. A gold standard supporter, Grant nevertheless supported the Pendleton plan for paying off federal bonds with greenbacks unless specifically stated that they be paid in gold. Paying for the war debt in greenbacks represented a commitment to slight inflation. For most voters, though, Grant, not the platform, was the deciding factor. His campaign slogan, "Let us have peace," appealed to people of both sections. In the election, despite the absence of three still unreconstructed states, 78% of eligible voters cast ballots. Grant received 53% of the popular vote, despite the fact that Seymour got almost 200,000 votes from Kentucky and Louisiana alone. Grant smashed Seymour in the Electoral College, 214-80. Some 500,000 blacks voting for the first time thus decided the election. Seymour took the highest electoral state, his home state of New York, but Grant took most of the North and swept the Midwest and all of the West except Oregon. Grant and the Era of Good Stealings. A reluctant politician, Ulysses S. Grant was as unimpressive in person as was Johnson. Sad-eyed, of average height, and possessing a low, musical, and penetrating voice, Grant punctuated his speech by frequently stroking his slight beard with his left hand. Courteous and capable of effusive laughter, Grant in portraits nevertheless looks as if he were attending a bullfight or a funeral. Full of personal contradictions, he puzzled even his best friends, including cartoonist Thomas Nast, who contributed mightily to the 1868 campaign. "Two things elected me," Grant later said, "the sword of Sheridan and the pencil of Thomas Nast." Early in his life, Grant and Longstreet had been close, and after Fort Sumter, he came to rely heavily on Sherman. Unlike Lincoln, who never lacked confidence around men of better education or status, Grant, according to Hamilton Fish, later his Secretary of State, was uncomfortable in the presence of highly literate or well-traveled men. Possessed of a detailed and organized memory, Grant could tell spellbinding stories and later wrote a military memoir considered the finest since Caesar's. When Grant claimed to be a simple soldier, he meant it. Once he put his trust in someone, he clung to them ferociously, and his loyalty led him to associate with self-interested leeches who had no compunction about betraying his faith in them. He viewed the presidency from the old Whig tradition, where the legislature made the laws and the president merely served as a check. To that extent, Grant had failed to absorb the massive changes in federal and presidential power that had occurred during the Civil War. Congress was all too happy to continue to direct Reconstruction, but the Republicans' first concern involved a diagnosis of the last election, which revealed that a great deal of Democratic strength still remained in the country. Had blacks not voted in the numbers they had, or had most of the former Confederates who were legally allowed to vote not boycotted the election, the Republicans could have suffered severe setbacks. Ensuring that blacks maintained the franchise therefore emerged as the top priority for the radicals, who sought to make black voting rights permanent. Grant had not even taken office when Congress passed the 15th Amendment, February 1869, that forbade any state from depriving a citizen of his vote because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. The recalcitrant southern states, Texas, Virginia, and Mississippi, that had not yet ratified the 14th Amendment, finally gave in, ratifying both the 14th and 15th, and all three had rejoined the Union by 1870. Obedience in any of these states, however, still largely rested on the bayonets of Yankee troops. Georgia proved that in 1868, when, after federal military forces withdrew, the state legislature expelled all black legislators until the return of federal troops again imposed Northern order. Probably many Southerners otherwise harbored humane and reasonable intentions toward the freedmen, but equality enforced at bayonet point hardened their antipathy against the North even more. To most white Southerners, all of Reconstruction was a facade, a ruse to conceal the Northerners' and the Republicans' true objective of crushing the South politically, economically, and culturally. Grant had scarcely taken office, and certainly had not yet started to grapple with Reconstruction, when his unfortunate associations plunged his administration into a scandal. On September 24, 1869, in Wall Street's Gold Room, two of the most infamous speculators in the country, Jim Fisk and Jay Gould, attempted to corner the market on gold. What ensued was Black Friday, where gold prices skyrocketed thanks to their backroom manipulations. Fisk and Gould had involved Grant's brother-in-law, Abel Corbin, who acquired insider information from Grant over dinner. Corbin relayed to the speculators that in the event of a run on gold, the federal government would not sell its gold, and thus the price would rise. Fisk and Gould had a long history of attempting to manipulate markets. Along with Daniel Drew, they had fought Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt over the Harlem Railroad in 1864. Now, 5 years later, Fisk and Gould were attempting another speculation. Armed with foreknowledge that the federal government would not sell any new gold, the conspirators started to buy all they could get at $135 an ounce. Once they had cornered the supply of gold and driven the price up to $160, they would dump gold and take the profits. For a while, it appeared they would succeed. But Grant, informed of the situation by his Secretary of the Treasury, ordered the Treasury to sell gold and stabilize the price. Gould escaped with several million dollars in profits, far below his expectations. Grant had in no way acted improperly, but the Fisk-Gould connection with Corbin tarnished his administration at an early stage. A second scandal, Credit Mobilier, tainted many congressmen and reached into Grant's administration, but did not involve him personally. The Credit Mobilier scandal was the logical result of using massive public funding for the transcontinental railroads, specifically the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific. To that extent, the trail of Credit Mobilier must first go through Promontory Point, Utah, where the Transcontinentals met in May 1869. Funding for the transcontinental railroads originated with a grant of 44 million acres of land and $61 million in federal loans, reflecting the urgency Congress placed on construction. Railroads could sell the land and use the proceeds